Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Adam Ross is the author of the novel Mr. Peanut, which was selected as one of the best books of the year by the New York Times in 2010. 2025 brings his next novel, Play World, a big and big-hearted book examining one transformative year in the life of a child actor coming of age in a bygone Manhattan. Griffin Hurt is in over his head. Between his role as Peter Proton on the hit TV show The Nuclear Family and the pressures of being a high schooler at New York's elite Boyd Prep, along with the increasingly compromising demands of his wrestling coach, he's teetering on the edge of collapse. Good thing he has a therapist that he shares with his parents and his kid brother. Surrounded by adults who embody the age's excesses and who seem to care little about what their children are up to, Griffin is left to himself to find the line between youth and maturity, dependence and love, acting, and truly grappling with life. Adam Ross's new novel is Play World, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. What a delight to have you on the program.
Hello, sir. How are you? It's great to talk to you.
I can't quite tell you how much I enjoyed this book because there's so much to it. And it's such an amazing story that you tell in such a vivid voice. And it is written so beautifully. I know it took you a long time. And I think 15 mm-hmm. years is roughly the...
15 years is the time between my last novel and this one. But I'd say it took a decade once I got going.
It seems like it would take longer than that to write this, mm-hmm. Just because of its beauty and precision. But let me ask you what the initial idea was and how far away we are from that in this final product.
Oh, wow. You know, initially the idea was that it was going to be a three-act novel. And in fact, I sold, based on a partial, the first 70 pages of a version of the novel that begins in 1999 when Griffin is 33 years old. He's a failed screenwriter and his entire life is collapsing. And that was called, Act One was called Gun. And it ends with Griffin getting a gun and him racing up to New York from Nashville where he lives to break up a character in the current novel's wedding and take revenge on another character. And those were really good pages. But what happened was when I moved into Act Two was called Play World, which was going to be the backstory, the novel just like ground to a halt. And I then spent a year trying to figure my way into the novel. And I was so stuck and I was in despair and I'd spent, you know, advance money. And I was talking with a friend and, you know, I said, oh my God, like, I don't know how to figure my way out of this novel, into this novel, blah, blah, blah. And they said, well, tell me about it. And I told them about, well, it's about this abusive wrestling coach and these inappropriate relationships with adults. And, you know, I was a child actor and I was the only kid on set and I'd have these inappropriate conversations. And I said, but it didn't seem strange at the time. And the person goes, that's a great line. And I was like, you know, that is a good line. And I raced home to my study and wrote, you know, I wrote the first line of the book or the first lines, you know, in the fall of 1980, when I was 14, a friend of my parents named Naomi Shaw fell in love with me. She was 36, a mother of two and married to a wealthy man. Like so many things that happened to me that year, it didn't seem strange at the time. And so suddenly the backstory became the primary story. And from there, you know, it was really a process of, there were just certain moments that I really wanted to get to in the novel. And whenever I begin a novel, I usually have a good beginning and I have an idea of the ending, but the middle is the hard part. So then I just spent the next, you know, 10 years linking up those moments that I wanted to get to. I mean, also, you know, I was raising two daughters and I took over a literary magazine, so I had other things on my plate. Yeah.
You know, you read the first line, but the second... two decades later, when I finally told my mother, we were on Long Island taking a walk on the beach, she stopped stunned and said, but she was such an ugly woman. That sets a tone. I mean, that's great.
You know, that line is such a thing an 80s mom would say. And it's such a thing, you know what I mean? Like,
Yeah,
it's such a thing that
absolutely.
an 80, it's such a thing that an 80s mom would say, like, oh, not, in other words, not, oh, wait a second, like, you know, you were in this inappropriate relationship with this 36-year-old woman, but oh, well, I don't know, I feel like you could have done better, you know what I mean? And that really speaks to, in some ways, the way in which adults throughout the course of the novel are strange and inappropriate, but also it is such, to me, a classic experience of youth, as you come into your own adulthood, of being baffled by adults and being baffled by some of the experiences you have in your encounters with adults. And to me, so much of the novel is about, I'm trying to bring the reader up close to some of these experiences, and then the Griffin from the future, who is in kind of tandem narrating this novel, extrapolates things from those experiences that give them language and give the reader some degree of understanding. But I will say it really is important in terms of how the novel operates, that there was really an intention to bring the reader, without any protection or interpolation by the narrator, up to these experiences, so the reader experiences with Griffin
Right.
their ineffable and unspeakable quality.
What fascinated me is that there wasn't a great disparity between those two versions of the voice, that it
Yes.
just seemed like a natural progression of the maturation of a human being and how one voice is impacted by what the other voice went through.
That is it, but that you put your finger right on the operation of the narrator's voice in the novel, and what was the trickiest thing to get under control, because you have to be, it's a first person narration, and you have to, you know, if Griffin, the child or the young man experiencing this, is too hip to the game of the novel, or too snarky, or too much of a, can I say smart ass, like too much of a,
Yeah.
you know, that he's going to be off-putting. And also, in that case, it would diminish the power of some of the things that are happening to him, because I think that that's the way life, I mean, so much of the way life operates, and honestly, you just articulated it as well as I can, which is that is things happen to us, and in our recovery from those experiences, and I'm not even talking about trauma, I'm just talking about in our recovery and puzzling out of what was occurring at the time, we give language and understanding to those things. And that's in flux. That's constantly in flux. And so, you know, because we, you know, we like to think that as we get older, we sit sort of solidly in ourselves. But okay, it's the stuff of great drama to me that occasionally things happen, whether they're recollected or whether we experience certain things later in life, that completely reshuffles our deck in terms of how we understand what occurred.
Part one and part two, you have the Carter administration and then you have the Reagan administration. I was reading this as obviously President Carter was passing, and it's so of the time, right? It
Oh my
is
God,
of that.
it's so spooky, right? I mean, it's
Yeah.
crazy.
One of the things that I loved about this character, you do not bring us to the showiest moments of what it's like for this kid to be an actor on a show that is
Right.
widely recognized. It's pretty much taken for granted. This is what he does. This is his
Yes.
it's as if he worked at Shake Shack, and he's Peter Proton, and this is what comes with that. And it's not bringing, I mean, there are these moments of you say, oh wow, that's a weird way for a kid to grow up. But by the same token, you don't glamorize it in any way.
No, and that's very intentional. It speaks to Griffin's dilemma. I mean, Griffin has fallen into acting. You know, he starts acting because he has this really fortuitous candid camera appearance that is the first time his father, who is himself an actor, is like, oh, my son might have some talent. But his family is in a state of economic precarity. And so, not in sort of a domineering Svengali way, does his dad like push him into acting, but his dad certainly capitalizes on what I call Griffin's gift for naturalism. But because Griffin doesn't go into acting with the same passion, for instance, that he wrestles, It is merely something he suffers, like an academic class he doesn't like. And that does deglamorize it. And the fact is that, especially in our current culture, with social media as a constant engine of FOMO and glamorization, I mean, acting itself, the business of acting, I was a child actor, is not, you know, it's not especially, you know, there's a lot of waiting around. There's a lot of breaks in between. It's interrupted play pretend. And if that jazzes you, great. But what jazzes Griffin, and which I think you're so astute to point out, is what jazzes Griffin is wrestling. And because wrestling is such a central thing for him, wrestling is treated with massive attention, massive glamorization. It is a place where, you know, the life of the soul is like contested. And that's where Griffin's soul and interest lives. And it's intentionally set in opposition to his life in acting, because that's where he figures out the kind of person he wants to be.
But then there's the dealing with a trauma around that he and his fellow wrestlers have to deal with.
He has an abusive wrestling coach. You know, it's so interesting how I think back in the late 70s, early 80s, we just didn't have a language even for some of these dangers. The child predator as an archetype in our culture was not something we would have been able to name. This is another adult who is absolutely inflicting harm on Griffin and his teammates, but is also someone who has access and is giving him an education in the very sport that he is so near and dear to him. And I think what's really important to emphasize in a literary period where, you know, there is something that critics have even named the trauma plot, where this is not a trauma plot. I mean, because there are, in fact, certain absolutely vital lessons that both Griffin's wrestling coach and Naomi, the woman that he's involved with, have to teach him. I think one of the things I've come to think about as I've talked more and more about this novel is that damaged people can teach us a lot. Damaged people can teach us a lot. And sometimes damaged people can teach us very important things. I would certainly never want that for my daughters. I would not want that to be the delivery system. But how we come into relationship with those terrible things we suffer is, again, I think, what the novel is investigating.
Adam Ross is our guest on this week's book show. Play World is the new novel. It is out from Knopf. I'm interested in that idea of there's an understanding of sort of the finding out about what is happening to Griffin, that the mother comes out of nowhere and knows more of what's going on than you would ever expect her to know.
I'm really glad you pointed out that plot point, because the harm she sees Griffin suffering is not the harm of sexual abuse. She sees the harm of him starving himself constantly, the weight. And Naomi, who is the person who kind of passes along that Griffin is in some kind of jeopardy, she may suspect what's going on with Griffin, but she doesn't have language for it either. So that there's a weird way in which Griffin's mother's intervention on his behalf is grounded again on a level of not fully understanding what's going on, which, if you think about it, is what the novel is doing. Like, the novel is like, I mean, sometimes our lives get saved by misunderstandings and accidents. And so in a way, it's going to be outside the frame of the novel that Griffin and his mom will maybe talk about what he, maybe in his 30s or later, realizes what was going on with him. Just like at the novel's opening and its prologue and its first line, or the line you read, I'm sorry, it never occurred to him to tell his mother what was going on, and which she had no idea about. One of the things I sort of like to say about the novel is that the novel's, if the novel had an English class kind of extractable theme, it would be that movement is our resting state. That's actually a line from my first novel, Mr. Peanut. And, you know, movement is our resting state, in that, you know, we're constantly revising who we are in the present moment by really examining who we were back then. And that is where there's a sort of weird kind of liberation in our own unreliability as narrators of ourselves, right? Like, because we actually get a chance to regularly be engines of our own salvation, be engines of greater compassion, if we're really willing to investigate what was maybe really happening or how we understand it.
A couple of things that I wanted to ask you about, and one is the idea that we certainly know about children as actors, and often that can be fraught. That is something that you, I think, maybe even subconsciously allude to, but certainly don't beat us over the head with it. But it does come in. It came into my mind as I was reading it. Oh well, you know, this is a weird life, and some people are going to relate to this better than others and react to it. Which I thought was interesting because you see, as I said, you see in this maturation of Griffin of someone who's also learning lessons. He's figuring things out along the way. To juxtapose that against what he's seeing in the relationship between his mother and father, who have their own issues, but yet keep coming back to one another because they really haven't found anything better.
That's right. And so what you point out is, again, another way in which the theme of, you know, movement being our resting state is absolutely central to the novel, because there's this moment where Griffin is reflecting on some of the things his psychologist, Elliot, says. And Elliot, his psychologist, is a master of the aphorism, of the pithy line. And at one point, his psychologist says, if life is cyclical, lengthen your diameter. And you know, it's his parents pose a question to Griffin, I think, in terms of how one loves someone else and what sort of evolution is possible in love. And that is, you know, without spoiling anything, given the decisions his parents make toward the end of the novel about whether they're going to continue to be married or not, is that a form of radical acceptance or is that a form of settling? And I think that one of the things is that, you know, it may be a form of radical acceptance for Griffin's mom, Lily, for instance. And it may be a form of settling for Griffin's dad, Shell. But that's not Griffin's life to live. And he's going to have to make his own choices about what he extrapolates from those people. But what I love about what you're describing, because it really is what it was the intention, is, again, you're right there with Griffin. You need to be right there with Griffin because the narrative wants you to be alongside him and make your own decisions about the choices that these people are making. Right. And your conclusions may not be Griffin's conclusions, but they're going to be yours. And they're going to inform how you decide to live and how you decide to change or not change.
I love how you describe that, too, because you are right there with Griffin. You're not there as much with Griffin's brother, Oren. And yet you can contrast and compare how these two brothers of what is affecting them in their lives and how it impacts one brother as compared to the other.
Absolutely. I mean, if you had to take a reader's poll, I mean, the people who have responded to me about this book, Oren wins going away as everyone's like favorite character. And,
yeah,
and look,
a great
and
character.
Look, I mean, it's a long book and there are a lot of characters and there are a lot of characters I dearly love, whether it's Elliot, the therapist, or Al Moretti, or Shell, or Tanner Potts, you know, whomever, even like the terrible principal, Mr. Fisley. But, you know, Oren is the novel's truth dealer. He is the one who, Griffin's mother always tells the truth, but Oren is the truth dealer in the sense that he may tell you the truth when you don't want to hear it.
Yeah.
And he is the one who has already been so adversely affected by this family where there are a lot of people who are either egoistical or self-interested or just blind to the accidental cruelties that are occurring, that it is exerting pressure on two brothers who love each other very much and are very loyal to each other, but are being forced to deal with the situations in ways that are entirely different. And in the case of Oren is having to make some very hard choices about how he's going to take care of himself. You see that happening. And I think it's, you know, when I hear authors say this, I kind of cover my eyes and I'm like, ugh, how are you saying this? But, you know, like, there are parts of that novel about Oren, just like there are parts about the father, that bring me to tears. You so clearly see the love this kid feels. And, oh my gosh, like how desperately he wants to express this kind of love. And sometimes he gets a chance to, like, there's a very climactic scene in a wrestling match where Oren gets a chance to mourn with his brother about a loss. And there are moments where, you know, you realize there's been this profound different version of a certain kind of family of origin tale that he and the brother are carrying around that has been affecting, unbeknownst to Griffin, everything about them. And again, this is like what happens. I mean, I'm really close with my brother. My brother and I speak every day, and it shakes me to my core when this person who I know so well tells me stories that even at my current age, I've never heard before. And it, I suddenly have to reevaluate things. I'm like, that's what happened to you? Like,
How did I miss that? Right.
How did I miss that? And also, I don't know if you have siblings, but also, like, where was I? Like, where was I that I wasn't protecting you? And where were you that you couldn't tell me? And it's like the most heartbreaking thing about being in a family. You know what I mean?
You talk about heartbreaking. I thought the scene toward the end where Shell is getting some success in the theater, and then Griffin is watching his dad and seeing in two roles and knowing that he's getting screwed in this deal, and yet to be proud of him at the same time. It's gutting.
So that scene, I cannot read that scene without completely breaking down. When I wrote that scene, I wept. When I was editing that scene, I wept. When I was doing the audiobook, I got choked up. I mean, like, yeah. It is absolutely gutting because Griffin's father's window for having the role of a lifetime is so small. And I just like to say, in a novel that, like, rhymes with my life, that was not the case with my father, who was an actor. I mean, like, you know, my dad definitely had his moments in the sun, but you know, that was just one of those moments where, you really get to talk about the dilemma for actors themselves. You know, my father was a working actor his entire life, and it is a profession where if you have agency in your life, you're the luckiest of the lucky. You are the 0.001% where you get to choose what you do. And so if you are so lucky that a role happens to come along that is absolutely in your wheelhouse, it doesn't matter for how short. I mean, Griffin can celebrate that with him. But also, I think in the novel, and I'm so touched that you were moved by this as well. I mean, it's so fleeting. It's so fleeting.
You mentioned your father and being an actor, and I know some of this is semi-autobiographical, but so I have been burning up Google trying to find out if your father really was the person to say these are not the droids we're looking for to Sir Alec Guinness.
He was not.
Okay.
No, it's hilarious because, you know, those moments are so much fun to write because, you know, again, you know, you and I are, I think, close in age. And one of the wild things about our era is whether it was television or movies, we have a shared mythology. Yeah. Like certain lines, certain commercial jingles, certain TV shows, like we were there together because that was all the media that we had. And so to have the father as a voiceover guy flitting in and out of of the novel's audio, as it were, like saying something. You know, my favorite one is Shell's father says, it's 10 p.m. Do you know where your children are? You know what I mean? And that was the kind of thing that, like, you heard all the time. And so in that way, Griffin's father is like the demigod of the novel, who is like everywhere present and nowhere visible. You know, his voice is everywhere audible, but he is nowhere visible.
So without playing armchair psychologist, because I don't have an armchair and I'm not a psychologist, but what it just seems to me, common sense would dictate to me that if you spend 10, 15 years on this book, it's so personal. It is gutting in many, many ways. What it's like to come out of that. I mean, you're in a part now where you're out and you're talking about it and
yes.
selling it. And then at some point you get back to another life.
You know, I really finished the novel in the sense of like finished all the editing, et cetera, et cetera. You know, at this point, like about a solid year ago, let's say, in a novel that uses a lot of aquatic imagery, just like there are certain coral crabs that leave like a hole in the coral from where they, you know, from where they live. I mean, like, this novel has like left a certain kind of hole in my imagination, in that I lived in that world and with those characters for so long that, you know, I'm definitely waiting to sort of reboot. But I'll flip it, and it's not so much, it's actually not a tragic thing. It's really more like this. It's like, I cannot overstate the personal sense of satisfaction I felt getting to the end of this novel and really feeling like I said everything about this time, this place, these characters as beautifully as I felt like my talent allowed.
The name of the new novel is Play World. It is published by Knopf. It's truly astonishing and just a gorgeous piece of work. Adam Ross, I congratulate you on writing such a beautiful volume, and I can't thank you enough for spending time and sharing with us.
It was such a pleasure talking to you, and I hope that your listeners know they have a really remarkably astute reader on their airwaves. Thank you so much.
Adam Ross's new novel is Play World. It is published by Knopf. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LaDuke. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.